Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
podcasts while walking, more rambling on philosophy and general insights. I can't quite think of what I'm going to talk about, but I'll try and cover that. I'm walking with a beanie on my head. Well, beanie, it's actually a moose. Moose little head with a little nose, and I don't know, sort of young sort of trendy girls wear it. I've got it on my head because it's absolutely freezing. Also got a corduroy jacket, but hopefully that doesn't zip. Trachy pants on because it's cold, and of course I'm holding for this 2-3 kilogram weights, or one in each hand, and I'm trying to get my backpack so I don't stoop carrying it, but I've got to try and do it. And the theory of carrying weights is to build up muscle strength as your upper arm muscle strength as you're doing it, and to load you down to make the hills a little bit more going up, so you get some more exercise. So firstly, why is it cold? Well, I'm broadcasting from Australia, Sydney, Australia, and generally we're called subtropical. Subtropics, it's bloody hot and humid. Sydney or Vancouver's got sort of the ideal air-conditioned climate the whole time, but Sydney's got a lovely warm climate. Sometimes it's a little bit hot, you have to really wear a hat on, but every once in a while systems break down and change, and we get a whole series of cold fronts, and it's absolutely freezing as you get so it's really hard to actually picture what's actually going. Alright, so it's a house I'm in, so I'm walking while I'm doing it. And you get the air off the Southern Ocean. Now, of course, the air, the Southern Ocean is absolutely rippingly cold. And let's actually dump snow on the mountains behind us. You can't see the snow because it's sort of like a flat plateau behind us, a flat plateau with huge canyons all the way through it. But further up, there's been a dusting of snow, and it's an absolutely icy wind, even though it's, you can feel the ice and cold, even though the air temperature is probably 8 degrees Celsius, so it's absolutely root-snorting cold. And what's more is it's so cold that it takes all the moisture out of the air. When it takes all the moisture out of the air, it just freezes. Oh, it's unbelievably cold. My poor little hands are cold doing this. So I'm quite a spooky sight. I would expect speaking with it. I can see that my shadow, I've got these big ears. I would scare the crap out of people coming along. And I sort of look completely unusual. So in general, I've got this real task, and you can sort of feel, if you think, oh, I'm super fit, but it, you feel the fitness slowly increasing, and I've got this huge battle of 87, so 87 kilograms, not the 1987, and I'm just stuck on 87 kilograms. I was losing a steady 20 to 40 grams a day. But now, 87, I don't seem to be making any headway, no matter how brutally I hit it. So today, I sort of started off good, only had one Weet-Bix, which is sort of one square of this compacted wheat biscuit and milk. Then I succumbed, sort of looked at a tuna, so I'm going to sneeze, unfortunately, and one of the fantastic things about this is now that I've had my heart fixed up, I can sneeze without worrying. Before, it used to be, I used to go into this panic and sneeze, I thought I'm going to blow apart, but now I can sneeze, no worries. It's sort of a strange a strange thing. Yeah, two slices of cheese, a bowl of old salad from a couple of days ago. This is apple and celery salad. I can well imagine people, 90% of the people who have switched off by now, and you're probably the 10% of people who can say, oh, this is interesting, I want to hear about someone being bloody cold in Australia and what he ate. Then I had some half leftover stir fried noodles. Try not to eat too much of that. Was still hungry. Had a bit of a plum. I suppose it's a plum. It's not plum. It's got sort of yellowy flesh in it. Not a nectarine. So nectarine is a cross between a plum and a peach. I don't know what these are. These are small little things. And then going into the into the train to catch to Sydney to pick up my daughter, I succumbed and had a sugary drink. Well, not, it's actually a no added sugar sugary drink, milk drink, and a toasted ham and cheese croissant. So there, I'm sort of blown away. And then dinner of two fish cakes and a bit of lettuce. And for my sins, I've got to really put that aside. I had to sort of lost the hunger battle today. I'm trying to reduce the amount of food I eat. I had in the morning 40 minutes exercise bike. So I've now been trained on how to do exercise bikes. You think any idiot could do it, but essentially it's watching your heart rate and warm-up period, an expenditure period, a warm-down period. So a warm-up period of 10 minutes, a expenditure period where I didn't actually hit my supposed exercise heart rate, and then a warm-down period of 5 minutes. That's 25. I think I did half an hour or 25 minutes. Going across now, I'm going to frighten the bejesus out of people. Now, at least my head is warm. I'm scratching my nose with my green, fluorescent green double. So if you can sort of imagine this in ultra-quiet Australia. Sometimes, when it's hot during the day, you can hear heaps of insects. But now it's frozen, you can't hear the insects. It's deathly quiet, quiet around here. And there's still some heat in the rocks and things like that. You can hear reptiles and snakes slowly making their way around. So you generally get used to listening to the bush stuff. And so, in the war, I've got to, not the war, it sounds like, I've got to actually hit two training sessions a day, and hopefully I'll get on top of that. And also podcasting. I have doing this chap called Hegel, and I've done sort of 1.5 podcasts, that plus a podcast while driving about this floating graphite on top of magnetic fields. And I suppose I'll get into that little bit, looking at Hegel. And so what's made me think is sort of, obviously the people, everyday people, are just not interested, can't give a stuff about philosophy yet. They'll vote for certain things, and they'll teach their kids certain things, and they'll ascribe to certain philosophies, but they're not really interested in listening to it. So it's sort of like the food they eat. They've always eaten a certain way. They'll only eat that, and they'll only serve that, and they'll only go to certain recipes of restaurants and stuff like that. And the meaning of wide range of culinary things and integration with different cultures, they'll tolerate them, but they won't actually sample or consider or engage in them. And so the majority of people don't, or she is, this is really, you can really feel the extra 6 kilograms walking up this slope. Oh, wow. Okay, yeah, so people get into it, but there's lack of investment into it. Now, unlike the rollout of train systems, or I suppose the technology, or your basic histories, the history of philosophy is indeed enormously complicated, because what happens is that a history of one piece of philosophy goes, and just various other aspects of it, of that period of history, go forward in the most unusual ways, and it turns up, and before you know it, gets mixed in with these historical accidents, which lead to what people think are actual truths. So if you'd like, a lot of philosophy is like the stage props of your thinking, and it's, yeah, very important to have a stage prop. So if you're going to live in Victorian play and dress up as Victorians, it's important to have the stage props there, and it adds mood and importance, and there's a whole lot of factors, whereas really good. However, it is a stage prop, and you have these people, a real tension between people who say, oh, look, my set of beliefs are absolutely real, they're founded in, but they'll give a list of sequence belief, or why they believe in socialism, or why they believe in free enterprise. If you're an American, why you believe it, must have a gun. But it's not a sort of question of questioning it, it's just bit by bit going through what's happening, and saying, saying the instances of Americans having guns, there was a big emphasis on guns and power. There were the thing which differentiated power and enabled the Americans to have power over the Indians, and the Indians, natives, First Nations tried to get it. So in this sort of power situation, guns became very important, and it's just looking back historically, you'd say, look, this is an interesting thing to look at. It would add a new dimension to look at this process. But if you look in the history of, did Americans have a right to own guns before they were invented? And what happens when someone eventually invents something more lethal than a gun, more effective than a gun? Perhaps that we have. This might be cyber spying and stuff like that. So there's that interest. And then there's also this sort of weird sort of cross confusion. And it's sort of like, not even, but there's this sort of base philosophical stance, this sort of use. So people use philosophy, and they don't want it to be deep. They want it to be real. If that makes sense, because they need it for their immediate structuring of their power play. They want to enact power on someone or a situation. They don't want to stop and say, what? I'm delivering my lines now. I'm not looking at the fact that this is not a real food in front of me. It's just porcelain or plastic imitation for the purposes of acting. Now, this brings me to this point where I'm often working through with a person, a hapless person, some degree of fraud. And if I can say, the general observation, this has got to do with philosophy, sort of the movement away from philosophy, is that if you decided, like, you could fight fraud and get on TV and stuff like that, or you could just stop it, slow it down, and turn it around, so you can just move on. There's people who aren't powerful, don't have lawyers to litigate, and all this type of stuff. You just stop it, and you move around. Now, when you're talking with people who are helping you do this and stuff like that, there's this, there's not this stress about it. It's sort of fraud and behaving badly is just part of the ecosystem. It happens, and you discuss with people how often does this happen. And in generally, it's down around the feeling of 10%, only a smaller minority of the society operate. Although you speak with police, they'll tell you that you know, you'd be surprised the fraction of people who are trying to game the system lie or go across. But speaking in my ordinary life, I find that really 1 in 10 people are having you on, a bit fraudulent, and if you slowly work away from them, you sort of get this sort of strange situation. And there's sort of the philosophy of, well, this really slows things, this small fraction, sort of a reverse Pareto analysis. Pareto says that 80% of your problems in generally caused by 20%. 80% of your stress is can be removed by solving 20% of your problems. So it's around that level, but sort of in a reverse thinking. And I've just gone through a process of methodically. We have this, you know, car to service, and there's the view that it's a safety. Cost of safety is having service by the dealer, and bit by bit this process has I suppose crossed the line, my personal line of what I would call honest dealing, and so they would make a recommendation. At a time, they've got your car, they make a recommendation. We really recommend we have this product, and do we have your authorization to go ahead? Then you find it's expensive. So we'll get locked into this very expensive stuff. And then we're going to do all of this, and it makes a huge profit. But when they're replacing fluids unnecessarily, that fluid is got to be manufactured. It costs a green cost of manufacturing, a green cost of disposal. So there's a sort of the contract with you to minimise your costs, and the contract with the environment put aside, sort of creating artificial wealth, so to speak. Like, all that work that they do is additional work. It increases our GDP, gross national product. But at the end of the day, it doesn't actually do anything. It's sort of, you know, philosophically, there's all these philosophical arguments which haven't had. And in general, I suppose, for me, I would say the two really fraud-driven areas, probably car dealers, and what that requires is to get them to itemize what they're going to do and then take it to another person and say, or will you ensure that you do all of this that they say and your price, and it's a cheaper price, and guarantee that, you know, armor plate yourself against it so that you can transfer without a sort of the third person looking on saying, oh, look, we have to pay, 50% more. Yeah, it is actually 50% more because of this unknown. And in fact, when you really look at a lot of things you engage in, you pay a ignorance tax in terms that people don't know how to not do it, and it's expensive to find out what it is. So it's an ignorance tax. It's the you're paying for the cost of remaining ignorant. May well be that. So that's one example, and that was just gritting your teeth, going through it, explaining it. Everyone knows it, and the people giving the quotes and helping you through it know exactly what you're doing, and it's part of this slow method going forward. Chew is. I'll tell you what, the extra 6 kilograms are really doing it. Now, in the education department, there's a similar thing in terms of there is this cost of fixing anything, fixing the knowledge, fixing the process. It's always too expensive for governments or anyone locally to fix, and it has a because it's too expensive, whenever there's that sort of thing where there's, but basically it's like leeches. If they're no good at finding out where the meal is, it's no good. So you, in general, you do find that these shonks get attracted to already. The sort of basic things that you tick off to say. You don't expect people to be shonky in a charity, because it's not the incentive there, it's altruistic. It's when people are purchasing something which has no physical value. So we're purchasing the dealership badge and simplicity, and we're doing a exchange of value to maintain our ignorance. And similarly with education, it's just too hard to change. It's much easier to let people in who will maintain the status quo, and if they do something wrong or tell a lie, something like that, it's too hard to find what they're going to do, and that they have everything sewn up in order to do it. So in a shonky car dealership, there's people that'll suddenly get angry or move you off the floor. I can remember when I bought a vacuum cleaner and it just completely fell apart, and they said, oh no, I didn't replace it. So I didn't know what to do. I brought it in, and they're all broken on the floor in front of them. This bit is broken. They fixed it up mightily quickly because their aim is to sell more vacuum cleaners. So while I was there, because of that vacuum cleaner suddenly changed. I didn't realise, I didn't do that deliberately. That's how it came across. So there's a simile here. There's, you've got to recognise that their business model is They've got no plans to change their business model. So their business model is locked in, and they have got buildings, service personnel, everything's kitted up. They're unable to do that. The bricks and mortar and who they have hired has locked them in the car dealership. I'm sorry to say that about car dealership. And I've got no emotional feel across them except when you have to look at the bigger picture, they're not going to be with you. People who have sunk all their time into this essential activity which doesn't add value to human existence, they're not going to be really interested in the fine details of human existence. They've shipped in the people, the buildings, and the values to create a little universe in which the high values of what's going to go is not ahead. And essentially, those little universes, you can't enter. You can only trade equally to them. The only way you can do with these little universes is just disengage, circle up, and move on. And essentially, they require sufficient gullible people to walk in. And the similar truth is with the education department. They've got the buildings, the institutions that have been hiring people up, the systems going up. One of the things is that if you say, look, you know, your teaching is out of date or incorrect, and this document opened up, it's not valid, you know, due to these things, they shut you down because they have to, in order to, it seems outrageous to people on the outside, but there is a certain logic to it. To actually know the spirit and the logic of what's going on. When I'm entering the national park, stretching my back a little bit, perhaps, you know, I think some of this stuff must build up. The overall strategy here is lack of engagement. If you can afford, if you can work through in game theory that if you engage, they have everything set up to maintain what they're doing. They have no intention of changing. They have intention of resisting changes. And all you can do is take your business elsewhere or proceed and build something else. So if they're building their business about petrol cars, you can say, well, look, in future there's going to be electric cars, driverless cars, let's focus on that. And you in general will not find a laggard in an advanced area. So there's a similar thing in education. There's no point strategically knuckling down. And in that respect, you then have the open question of philosophies and basically how do people use philosophies. And people basically pick their philosophies that their parents have given or that they've picked up from TV. It's sort of like a philosophy being like an interior decoration of your own mind, and they allow themselves to be interior decorated around the place, and they can't really see that a philosophy is like, their philosophy is like an interior decoration, and that they have to start experimenting and researching and perhaps moving this, imagine a painting or a capture philosophy around the place inside the head and seeing how it works, and if it doesn't work, sort of making themselves a logical engine based on trying to work out how they feel, what it goes. So this is sort of a area of philosophy, knowledge of philosophy, at a fairly sophisticated level to check that you are sufficiently flexible. So it's sort of like philosophy is like a good heart condition. It's sort of, or you've got to apply it in different ways and see how it goes, or like a team sport. I don't know to go through. So that's a sort of a high use of philosophy. Then there are these philosophical backgrounds which almost go into policy. So where philosophy eventually becomes policy, a philosophy sort of backs up or hangs together a policy. So a policy is a set of consistent behaviour. Policy is a behaviour guide. A process is a process. A process is a set of steps that is written down, or can be written down. If followed, will produce a policy outcome. So if your process contradicts your policy, it's time to stop and question it. Your process should have a step in it which allows executive compliance with your policy. If not, your policy is pointless. You may as well skip the policy step and just give everyone a series of procedures, and sort of like getting society up on conversational English only. You teach everyone conversational English and set them off. See how it goes. So policy's at a higher level, and the policy, sitting behind a policy, is certain philosophical principles, which the policy has to be consistent, is within. So a policy should be able to be looked at, and the philosophy of it. Now, this is not this is a philosophical conclusions or statements, but then there's a philosophical framework. So that sort of gives you two uses of philosophy. This is so the highest level of understanding philosophy, the different types of uses of philosophy, and the internal mental fitness that one has if one understands philosophy properly. But then understanding how philosophy goes into policy, goes into strategy, goes into outcomes, and then ultimately you measure your outcome. Is your outcome philosophically consistent? What does your outcome say to you philosophically? And then that should feed back into either modification of the outcome, or improvement of the philosophy, or improvement of the policy, or just even improvement of procedures at those three levels. Now, a lot of people have a philosophy of not having philosophy. They have a philosophy of stick the procedure, and as long as I've stuck to that procedure, it's okay. Now, there is the people with such poor understanding that they can sort of jump the procedure. That is, you get sort of junk procedures, sort of bits of procedures rising up, and a little bit of this going across. So across my watch, I have bits of procedures come across, and when you look at it, the procedure is just really at the conduct of that procedure. But there's a procedure to run the procedure, and that procedure to run the procedure has checks and balances, and people working job descriptions, the whole sequences of. So if you have something wrong in front of you, it's not a matter of just sending it back. It's a sign of something more. So if you've got a nervous twitch and you can't hold a cup of tea, one thing is, well, not to hold the cup of tea, which is okay. And then if you have a cup of tea and it spills, you clean it up. But it's actually a deeper sign of it, all the way through to have you got a good relationship with a doctor, with people, with your world view? Ask a whole lot of questions. Now, if you've got a whole lot of people who are have got issues at this very high level, they're going to just say, you're a real insensitive bastard talking about my twitch and all that sort of stuff. You know, I don't like you, and the sort of standard things, which are really a symptom of people who haven't gone into procedure enough. Now, this is a sort of a really weird thing, because in a former life, I'm sort of going down this slope, and you know what's going to happen? I'm just going to go down to the gorge and turn around and come up again, because I am carrying these 6 kilogram weights, two, 3 kilogram weights, and it's absolutely going to kill me. Well, I hope it doesn't kill me coming up. But what I'm trying to say here is that one of the key things is not to be completely tuned in to someone who's done something wrong. There, it's unlikely that and it requires a certain amount of reflection, that if you ask them simply, what have you done, and there's a whole tsunami, history, years, structures behind it, they're not going to say, oh, I know I've done wrong. The problem is that they don't know why they're doing wrong. I think a lot of people feel that's how you do it. And it is true that would be how one operates in a situation which is completely stuffed and incomprehensible. Because the bottom line is that they haven't actually comprehended the bigger situation. They haven't comprehended the bigger mission. And the bigger mission is perhaps that, if you had to say it, in the biggest thing, philosophies aside, we have to go through the next 20 years, our next generation, in such a way that we arrive at a good, sustainable outcome. So essentially, we're in a lifeboat and we're fishing at certain rate. There is a certain sustainability. We've got to operate such that we all live and it's the greatest outcome. Essentially, if you are sitting there not being productive, ripping people off, not realizing that you have to understand a certain amount, you will cause damage. Now, this is not necessarily this cause damage, get out of the way. It's this sort of thing evolves and creeps up. The water level of inspection slowly increases. So let's take us the we are the benefit of doctors who have looked after our well-being, and their philosophy of wanting to look after our well-being has well and truly gone ahead of the actual their ability. I shouldn't say this. I just realized that I was just really hoping I was at the end. But no, there's another. I'm only halfway down. I'm going down. So you think going downhill with 6 kilograms will be okay? But the thing is that if I really got up and took the blowtorch to doctors and absolutely ripped the medical profession ahead because it didn't meet modern. If I could get in a time machine with my medical knowledge of germs, biologics and stuff like that, And I went down and I, with videotapes or DVDs and DVD machines, and show the modern era of x-rays and stuff like that. Firstly, it would bamboozle people, demoralize people, and the end result is it would never get there. So one has to understand, I'm thinking going back to Elizabethan England with a modern children's textbook on how the body works. If you showed that, people would just create complete confusion and pandemonium. And so in a certain sense, one has to be a bit more sophisticated. One doesn't have to really go head-to-head with the car dealership. One has to just support and educate people to move away from it, and it will wither eventually. Hopefully it will wither. And with the education system, unfortunately, it's all about recruiting people who can miseducate people, but feel that they are educating them. The medical profession was very well paid and respected, and they managed to convince themselves that they were curing people by bleeding them and stuff like that. And so there's this general feeling of what the say education profession can do ahead of what it's actually doing, and one can see the structures and processes in there have it such that it's obviously, because it's not educating, it's got these other factors in there trying to convince people that by putting people down, it's all, because it's actually not based on basically logic and getting things done, it's got this other thing, and you can't, you'd be mad. It's sort of like, I don't know, you've got the, you're in the Han Hot province, and a new empire has come up. You just really have to bide your time and not get yourself executed and develop your gunpowder and see how it goes, because it's just that strategic long-term thinking. Now, the important thing is that these people, you've got to pour in philosophy at a certain point. The people are just not skilled in making the connections all the way from philosophy, policy, procedures, outcome. They're not skilled in making the connection. And part of their lack of skill of making the connection is a lack of interest in philosophy, and also a lack of interest into how philosophy interacts with the whole stuff. They don't need it, because they're just churning procedures out, because they have sort of a personal philosophy of promoting themselves or making a fast buck or explaining how they can exist without ever fully understanding what the situation is. They are really committed to it. And a lot of the actual, if you look at the, a lot of philosophers go into the world, part of it, philosophy has little sections in it about aestheticism. I think, it wasn't positivism. Schopenhauer. A lot of them, you can actually pick up the fact that one has to not be worldly. There's a whole series of things where philosophies have tucked in there. They have these 18th or 19th century philosophies are brilliant, because they've got a small little bit and they just attack everything. There's no sense that they've got limitations. They look at maths and ethics and religion. They're fix it do all things. Someone comes up to it and they want to have, it's sort of like a McDonald's thing, time menu. They're not a specialist philosophy. At a certain point is that you've got to have a device in that philosophy to allow people to go in. Now, I'm going to take a break here before I turn around. And you'll hear this. That's the kilogram weights stopping. Okay, I've now had my sort of 30-second breaks, and you'll after hearing those 3 kilogram things, I sort of feel tempted to just leave them there, but they are bright green. They're not going to survive there. I'm going to have to take them up at some stage. So I've got to go pick them up, sort of squat down and pick them up, not use my back. Oh. 1, 2. Oh. So look, you... Oh. You can be grateful that you're in your car and you're not doing this next section. You get a feeling that in terms of philosophies, reading these philosophers, and they write tomes and tomes of books about absolutely everything, and they've got, and it's really good because you've got that philosophy in it. It's just like a little car. It drives all over the countryside, taking holiday snaps of absolutely everything. But I think they're a bit like the old department stores. Yeah, here's the philosophy. They build it as a building, and you get in a lift, and here's the ethics section, and here's the rooftop garden that looks up to God and all that type of stuff. And when you look at Locke, definitely like that. Bacon, like that. They start to do science. So then when science comes off, science is more like a factory or a specialist store, like a sporting store. You come in there and the idea is that you're doing sport and everything's more activity-oriented. Whereas Schopenhauer and Hegel are all stuff like that, and Hegel is an overtly consumer's choice. Hegel is like I suppose you could say Kant is sort of like pre-PC, Schopenhauer is probably like PC, and Hegel is like Apple. It's philosophers which are easy to take, and people say, oh, the main thing with Hegel is people say, oh, this philosophy, it doesn't cover everything. Ah, well, if you haven't thought, there's the philosophy here, this thought, and then there's the not philosophy of it, and we pack it up. So it's your thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and here it's packaged up. So it's sort of by definition going to work, and you have to be... Immediately, it's really the one alarm bell that you have to have, and it's this thing that, crap, sorry, the wind's picked up a bit. Oh, the wind's picked up hard. So what this, imagine that 6 kilogram used to be in me. Whoa, so I've lost 10 kilos, and, so going up the slope used to be a lot heavier. So it's 80s. Yeah, 10 kilos more. Used to be real powerful, and you can sort of feel it. So the Hegelian philosophy is uh, 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 really got the elements in it. It's when does the philosophy become a dogma? And it's when the philosophy itself locks the store, the doors, inquiry doors, coming up. Now, so you've got your philosophy, your sophisticated knowledge of philosophy to question your own thinking, structure your own thinking, expand it unlike others, a philosophy as a logical back end into a mission statement. Now, I'll tell you what, having studied an MBA, right, and military stuff where you got a campaign and a structure, and then the sort of the outer headings of mission statements come across, and then you sit in a school staff room and it says, look, we've got a new idea, we're going to have a new strategic direction. By having a strategic direction, what? You've got another theory of strategy and how a strategy works, and we're going to produce a mission statement which is going to guide the strategy, and everything's going to just complete complete madness. So there's the thing of philosophy there, the idea of philosophy as being a meta-Bible coming across the place, but philosophies link in with sort of directly a philosophy and human behaviour is one in a religion. So one way of looking at a religion is, or a corporate ethos, if you really wanted to put it, it's where you can have the philosophy in one hand and the cattle prod in the other, and you can cattle prod people where you want to, and then just quote the philosophy to come across. So, but I'm a little bit more serious on that. That there is two distinct structures of knowledge. They both have use. One is folk knowledge, that is belief in fairies, gremlins, spirits, stuff like that. And ultimately, there's a very little unchallengeable evidence, that is, for a fairy. One can find other answers for it. However, folk knowledge requires a folk tradition plus the folk who believe in that folk knowledge. So fairy tales are good and superstitions are good. They're a bit liable if an individual holds it for their own business, but if a whole society has a superstition, it produces folk knowledge. And essentially, before experimental science came along, you know, Neolithic man and Paleolithic, I don't know. Paleo, I think, must have been much earlier. Came along, there was only folk knowledge, and that was the main structure. Now, folk knowledge has the advantage is that it's held not on paper, but on folk belief. It's got philosophy and behaviour, cheek and jowl together, an explanation system, cheek and jowl, and it has the advantage that the knowledge is of questionable valuable, but it is particularly valuable if everyone believes it at the same time. So this is important when you're hunting animals or you are programming people to go by various things of folk knowledge. You also have the ritualistic calendar where at a particular time of year you do certain activities which have been optimized. I have a folk festival, probably consume your food at midwinter, because you know that midwinter you can sort of judge how tough part of the winter is, and you optimize the eating of supplies so you can't be raided by other people. Supplies can't be taken from you. So you're inside people who are able to defend the remaining supplies. So if you had a dork who made everyone starve, compared to tribes who didn't do that, the tribe who fed up all their warriors at midwinter would be able to, you know, if there wasn't enough food, what you'd have to do is raid another tribe, and if you starved everyone, you know, it's a way of doing it. So these folk things and calendars were able to organize people. So these folk beliefs and calendars of feast days, you know, what is a feast day? It's a day where society feasts, and also giving everyone together to feast means that there's an equal distribution of food and the transfer of social power structures. Now, a feast day acknowledges the chief, and it's got a whole lot of structures in it. So this is folk knowledge, really good. Now, obviously with supermarkets freezing, iPhones, this folk knowledge can be wound back a bit. We have this hankering for folk traditions, so we still have Christmas, but then we have sale days, because that's what we're really interested in processes and the essential folk traditions weren't necessarily sustainable, but they were competitive. That's a slightly different thing. Being more competitive means that the winner is sustainable, but for the entire system to be sustainable, the competitive behaviours can actually, you know, you could imagine putting it aside. And then with the folk beliefs came convenient structures, which we still have to teach people about folk beliefs. So one folk belief, believe it or not, is money. You know, that piece of paper in front of you, or in Australia, piece of indestructible plastic, boil up before it burns, heat damage. A piece of paper is a piece of paper. It's the brilliant application of folk knowledge to that piece of paper, which gives it social value because the folk knowledge has been pushed right across the society. So if I steal that piece of paper from you, the court will punish me, lock me up, and so we have this system, a court system, which deals with the intersection of folk knowledge and scientific knowledge. Now, scientific knowledge has slowly been increasing, and scientific science still runs on philosophies and principles, but they're a different set, and so there is this fundamental conflict between a folk system, which is, say, well, it's definitely our education system is a folk system. There's a folk, it's got all the folk symbols of folk things. It's got ceremonies, it's got the creation of printing money. It doesn't print money, it prints accreditations for people. It manufactures them, regardless of whether they've legitimately got it or not. And it actually ultimately doesn't matter whether the information is true, real, or useful. And it's unsurprising that in a folk system, you have a folk culture. Wow, I'm out of here, doing quite well with the 6 kilograms. I'm sweating like a pig in this big jacket coming up. So, yeah, you've got this system here. So, it has been a major signature of a folk knowledge conflict. So folk knowledge most often used to come into conflict with other folk knowledge. So a particular king or administration would have to have a particular folk knowledge system. And so in order to get people to change their folk knowledge system, you'd have to burn the other person's temples and basically crucify the leaders. That is, put the leader through a painful death that others could see but would have to elect not to help, and get a teach the population that if you are attached to a way of thinking, you will be punished. So the trust system, so the folk system has a combination of trust and punishment, and by and large throughout history, the majority of folk systems have been fighting each other. So it's not at all surprising to see these unwritten things. It's sort of like a folk knowledge, a folk para philosophy to enforcing philosophies. So in communist Russia, if you didn't believe in the right brand of communism, even though you might be, you know, as red can be, if you were the wrong type of red, critically there, you'd be taken off and natural justice. So now the thing is that our justice system and our procedures are becoming more and more political and scientific, evidence-based, procedure-based, linked up. They're becoming more not happenstance, culturally evolved, but systematically linked between an action all the way back up through procedures, policies, to philosophies, with safeguards. And so the ancient way of enforcing a folk belief is the delegation of folk power. So you have quite lowly people, people in families and that type of stuff, doling out folk justice based on a folk system. So it's a social network that's providing the behaviour. And there's this system to go ahead now. In ancient times, there was just one village, one market, and you could do it. At the moment, we've got lots of markets, lots of the internet. It's all dividing it up. And what's happening is that people can this entire way of entering into a philosophy as a as an apartment store where the philosophy does everything for you, that's no longer sufficient. People are asked to occupy things in this great non-focused system. So hopefully it's a non-focused system, and therefore they have access to the internet. They've got and procedures and policies, but there's the training and insight to do it. They're just not there. So you can clearly see from the way people structure these documents, or you look them up and you see the lack of their interests. So you look at, you know, someone sends you a document and you say, I wonder what the job description is, I wonder what the procedure is behind this, and you look at them and you look at them at LinkedIn, their interests, they got a degree many, many years ago, not much, but they're in Anthony Robbins. Their philosophical background is in the airport lounge, something that their mum gave them or something like that. It's essentially a philosophy of the similar to Hegel, actually. In fact, Hegel was a bit of the Hegel, and these philosophers were the Anthony Robbins of their day, because if you look at it, they have these self-help books, Have Everything Answered. And so, sort of similar to the day, there were people who would just only believe one thing. Now, there's that interest in philosophy. There's also the interest in the philosophy because a series of papers by people, Einstein, really, well, firstly, a lot of people just read the title of the papers and don't read the actual papers themselves. Then they don't read the structure, and then they don't read, say, Einstein's comments. Oh, Christ. Just went to wave at someone in their car with a 3 kilogram weight in my arm, and their arm's about to drop off. I'm trying to move my shoulders back so I don't sort of turn up tomorrow. So I'll be doing strength training tomorrow for an hour. But it's really good because they teach you how to lift up dumbbells properly. And can't do enough. I really need oil. Oil put in. Now the interesting thing is that you look at the section of people that the philosophy of the people that they teach in schools, right, and you track it down, and this person has basically a football philosophy and it's been sponsored by a beer company, and his ideas are stupid. And you know what they do is they say, here are the ideas, and we test you on to why people say they're stupid. Let's leave it like that. But if you look at, their philosophies, so I'll pin them up on the board, pin up their philosophical background. So their philosophical background possibly goes back to Newton, and then you look at the other people, where we want people to go. Their philosophical background goes to reaction against Newton, through Christianity, Washer, through this self-help thing, through these things, and then you have these people saying Wolfgang Pauli, Schrodinger, Einstein, the big people who actually did do the equations, did do the hard work, which are too complicated to teach, have all. So Einstein had the picture of Faraday, James Clerk Maxwell, a beautiful man, wish I understood more about him, and Schopenhauer. So Schopenhauer had these enormously, they weren't racial. It was a critique of the Jewish religion. And then eugenics. Things which were just going to evolve and flower. coming through, and the eugenics was proposed by Plato. It's just that people just read sanitized versions of the incomplete version. But the important thing is that Einstein did it, and Einstein had these busts of these three people up, either paintings or busts of them, in his study. And Einstein used to spend a lot of time reading Schopenhauer, and trying to actually work out what Schopenhauer was saying is this idea of the will. Now, people, how can anyone study German history and Nazism, stuff like that, if they don't quite understand the philosophical mechanism in it? They just parrot what American propaganda said about it all, and what's safe to say. And I sort of don't know why they don't get it, but there's the idea of the will, which is the primeval idea, and then Hegel is, wait for it, the state that eventually people will realize and become little ants of the state. And the search for idealism, and I think idealism is working out how the planet can be from first principle, a set of principles like God, or what's the ideal utopia, Mill's utopia. Or you can say there's sort of obviously go through a utopian stage when you set out on an expedition, but at a certain point in time you realize that in order to survive, it's a question of survival. And I really think we have to cross to that point and say, look, philosophy, we really need to know more about it. We need people qualified in philosophy. We really need to train people up. So we have officer training in the Australian Army. We don't have officer training in education or other major strategic directions. The reason that education is unable to take a strategic direction, it can follow its strategic lead, but it itself cannot lead, because we have not trained our education people to be officers. That is to take charge and look at it. Now, to my horror, there are these Rambo people in education where you don't think, you rely on your own, there's no forming your relationship with the intelligence community, a larger structure. You pick it up and you take charge, and people either you have followers who are really not your friends. They're eyeing off the resources that you have, and you shoot deserters. And essentially, you can get sort of like the communist commissars sort of G'ing up their Russian troops to go over the top, and people who want to argue go back behind with them to argue, and you hear these shots rung out, and they said, anyone else want to discuss that? And of course it goes. And this is all okay if you're not interested in winning the education war, you're only interested in getting a red star and getting a promotion up above the front. You can do it. So I can see that, but I think before people can see, people haven't really seen the need for leadership training, and people who really haven't charted out, say, their vision of where education has to go in 20 years. I would say it's a 20-year project to get Australian education where we want to. And it involves rejigging our syllabuses so they have real science and not this medieval scientific concepts in it. And it means developing sophisticated leadership people. And I think there's this great thing that if we develop true leaders, innovators and stuff like that, it would be a good resource to hold people off. Because what happens, I really believe, say that we have a class of say 20 physics people in third year, and 10 go on to honours. Really, there's of those 10, they can pick about half the right, and so half the people they pick are wrong, and half the people they exclude, or five of the people they exclude, are wrong. So if you can provide a career path to educate those people and hold them in, possibly you could remove those people. We've got a very much a linear approach and not a sophisticated leadership approach. The idea of, there's heaps of things I can see that one could do. One would be able to sort of take a leaf out of the gravitational wave thing, where you inject a signal and see how the system produces. That is, in training, have a training day where across the state, on the same day, everyone has to solve a solution and feed it in. It's a training exercise. So it may be that a situation unfolds and you have to get your resources to do, your school psychologists, your calling parents, notionally write it down, and you can compare and contrast. There's this drill, we have fire drills and stuff like that, but we don't have drills to do it. You have this person, say it comes to your attention that a particular person, and for all the right reasons, puts their hands up and says, look, this is unethical, there's a lot of bullying going on here. They say, oh, right, hold off for a while, and then they can put this right across and actually see, is there a uniform, is this response to this staff member saying, oh, I've been bullied, is that uniform right across the state, or does it in Western Sydney or Northern Beaches or whatever it is there a different type of response? What's going on here? We don't have the basic internal intelligence from training. And one of the things with intelligence is that you basically have to have your people focused on winning the battle, whatever it is, and essentially you start from the premise that the people you are against are slightly mad and they're missing something, and also your people are slightly mad and they're missing something, and you want them to achieve the strategic goals. One of the strategic goals is not that they are perfect and they understand everything and they feel good and their morals are good. You want them to achieve their goal, and to achieve it, their goal, you have to, so they're mad, we're mad, let's get the strategic objective sorted out, where hopefully the poor civilian population, which is just suffering fatigue of mad people hopping around the place. We'll put them aside for the moment, and maybe you've got to interface with the mad psychology of the enemy, or whatever it is. Not necessarily enemy, but get them to get off balance and start fighting themselves. And this is a very ancient concept. I'm mad, they're mad. That's okay. Let's get to see what we can feed into that system, sort of game theory, to go. So this theory of game theory is von Clausewitz's center of mass. It's the structure of their belief, which is the linchpin which creates the inner behavior. Essentially, four battles at the beginning of it. In that no philosophy or nothing that you will fight for will last for very long anyway. Essentially, you want to get a situation where people are being constructive and not bashing everybody's brains out, and not the equivalent of bashing people's brains out, but just taking taxes and putting it in their back pocket, basically, not educating people. That's equivalent to going to villages and raising them to the ground. It's winning the battle, but it's not winning the war. You've got to win that peace. And so, roles in the intelligence role is to actually you're not there to create a better world. You're there to understand the strategic outcome, and it's very rarely, well, at least it's very rarely in a strategic Australian strategic outcome that we occupy someone else's territory, or we have one where there's a permanent Australian force there. This can't be. So we occasionally sort of send out people to Solomon Islands or Rwanda or things like that. Or Bosnia. The idea is that you have a truth and healing mission, whatever it is, and you win the peace. The ultimate aim of any army or anything like that is that fewer people die. That is, actually fewer enemy die, because it's no longer an issue they want to solve by throwing bombs at you, which is essentially all Australia can hope for, because we've got such a minuscule sort of fly of an army across, or that things are done in good faith for the up there, you can actually see that in a few, if you read a few of the, there actually weren't successful military commanders. They only lasted a short time before they were swapped out, and this type of sort of bigger belief is coming across. Now, the important thing is that this bigger belief hopefully transcends for a longer time. So I think to fix the situation, there is really a 20-year plan, which is I could go, and it's to say in 20 years' time, when do we want to be, and how, and say that we're there. Can we say, how did we get here? And this always happens, say, in a medical emergency or anything like that, where things haven't gone perfectly right. You know, people, it's been saved, but it's been saved by emergency care and interventions, a sequence of interventions which perhaps wouldn't happen. You just ask the question, not who's at fault. You don't have to start off with a hypothesis. You start off with the question, how did we get here? And so I can see doing that now for me, to unpick philosophy requires me to read in depth, and to read in depth requires understanding of these weird and wonderful concepts like monism, which led to Leibniz, which led to our era, to try and understand people's belief and desire for an all-encompassing philosophy. And if you have, people basically got an all-encompassing philosophy is something pretty amazing, because what it looks like in reality is a 16-year-old, 17-year-old educated gets that philosophy drummed into them, dressed up and pushed over the top to battle up another 17-year-old who believes he's been fighting for another philosophy. They can't really fight them. Can you really believe in anything if they first don't understand it? And overall, this is a dreadful waste. It's very expensive for society to dress up a soldier. Very risky, because that soldier can easily do the wrong thing. And a huge opportunity cost, because with the correct education, that soldier could possibly be doing something completely different, like doing medicine, or caring for people, or researching things, or at the very least, living a life with a smaller carbon footprint to go across, or being able to undergo certain thoughts and esteems that they're positive in their society and they're not falling apart. So it's a bit of a tragedy at the moment, in that when you came from World War II, World War I, lots of people just fell apart, and few people survived really contribute to society. But essentially, what you want to do is not say that we've got an expectation that people must contribute and repay society. It is we want a society in which conditions we communicate the value of people contributing to society, we communicate conditions that they contribute to the society, and hey, if we cultivate society such that people contribute the most is there, that is. There's a theory that you can cheat some wealth, that people, if people have two cars and, additional wealth, they're still going to keep on producing. I don't think so. That's, that material wealth doesn't really add to the quality that we're going in. So that being said, we've got the philosophy, and going back in, you've got folk philosophy, and folk philosophy, to be founded on anything, has to be founded on God. So all Plato, Aristotle, Hegel, Kant, even Newton, was God as a thing, and now we're moving beyond, and the philosophies were village philosophies, small townships. Now we've got these mega cities which are crisscrossing the earth. People can jump on jets and see things from space. Now that we've merged there, our philosophy has to improve. And this is not that people should become more philosophical. They require a greater knowledge of philosophy. And unfortunately, for me, that means, this is obviously with cognitive stuff, it's trying to retain information in your head, names and stuff like that, that disappear. You've got the general, I think it's quietism. That's what Schopenhauer had, which is the quietism that is unplugging from the folk, the noise, like folk signals are very good because they're very noisy. Noise signals are good because it means they're highly accurate. So the thing of getting conflicting signals, which are either off and on, you can take the average and take a highly exquisite thing. So the fact that there's folk signals don't go in there, but they can actually preoccupy people. So, yeah, but it's just trying to remember. I can remember Kant, not others, but it's history, but I have to really go back and do it. So, that being said, I've done my 6 kilograms of weight. It's hitting my house again. So I have to say good evening. And this is just around 1 hour and 31 minutes. So I've got the same distance and the same time, but 6 kilograms. Yeah, thanks a lot for listening. It's just a ramble, and I suspect no one will ever bother really listening to it. It doesn't really matter, because like, at least I'm speaking out there. I think I'm speaking to someone, so that's at least someone tricking my brain. I'm having a carrot in front of me, a cognitive carrot in front of me, with blinkers either side of me. And obviously it hopefully means that if I'm doing balancing and carrying weights at the same time, it's helping my brain rebuild. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.